listening to Trending with Timory. National speaker Timory Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. They cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timory.
Hello, everyone. With me in studio is Carlo Broussard. He is a Catholic apologist with Catholic Answers, and his recent book, just a few months ago, came out, and it is titled Prepare the Way, and it works to help you in really responding to your friends, family members who are skeptical about the faith, but
That's
with
right.
questions.
Amen. Yeah, it coaches you in strategies on how to remove certain obstacles to truth, God, Jesus, Christianity, and the Catholic Church, primarily dealing with unbelievers who deal with these obstacles and skeptics to Christianity. So it's sort of, you know, it's that book that provides you with a catalog of common questions that you get from the nuns out there, right? So it's for so long, apologetics has been centered on the Catholic-Protestant dialogue. And there's few and far in between Catholic books out there that deal with the unbeliever Catholic dialogue, right? Mm-hmm. And how we can evangelize unbelievers, which is growing in our modern culture. And those are the ones we're bumping shoulders with, you know, in the cubicle at work or on the airplane or wherever.
Now, these questions, I'm curious, are they questions where you already have to be kind of deep and somewhat conversing on the issues, or could they almost be talking points where you're with someone and it's small talk? What do you think about this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was on an airplane and a lady brought up the problem of evil. You know, she was expressing to me how she was left by her husband and he's trying to win over her two sons and she's experiencing, you know, misery and sorrow, and how could an all good God allow all that, you know? So, so stuff like that, as practical as that, that we all struggle with, you know, and it could be the issue of the church's teaching on sexuality, which is one of the chapters and an issue that I address in the book. So the church's stance on human sexuality and opposing saying yes to the good of procreation and unity love being inseparable, and saying no to any sort of sexual activity that would divide those two goods of sexual activity. And so why is that? And how do we overcome any sort of obstacles that we have to that?
A fantastic tool. That is Carlo Broussard, and we're talking about his book, Prepare the Way. Coming up on the show, we're going to be talking about the children's movie Smallfoot and some of the philosophies you picked out of it. But in the meantime, we're going to be talking about bravery and how some people are saying that is coming out as a drag queen in your teens. We'll also talk about sentimentalism and how it's an ideology that's really vetting people against one another. It's destroying truth and real morality. But you were watching Good Morning America over the last few days, Carlo, and you were astounded by something you saw.
Yeah, so his name is Desmond. I think his sort of stage name is Desmond the Amazing, if my memory serves me correct. And so he's like the youngest, I think, drag kid. And so he dresses, you know, in drag and walks and performs. And they had a video of him walking in drag at the parade, the LGBTQ parade, right? Pride parade. And, you know, he goes and does shows to where he walks in this sort of sassy, unfortunately sexual fashion, where he's dressed in drag. And on the Good Morning America, they had several other famous drag queens come out and support him. But the whole idea, and he's 11 years old, right? Mm-hmm. And the whole idea is that on the video, on the show, on the episode, he's stating how he's happy that my mom accepts me, and it's all about for who I am, right? Mm-hmm. Who I am. This is who I am. And first of all, I think about that, and I'm like, 11-year-old, do they really know who they are? you know, in a definitive way that you're going to relate to them according to what they think they are, you know? So that's a problem. That's problematic to begin with.
I'll post the link out to the video because you see it, Carlo, and automatically this is a kid that is warm, bubbly. He's a performer. He's right. Got a lot of personality.
Yeah, amen.
He is a total performer. And I think you and I both get that. We've come from performing type of industries. For those who don't know, Carlo had a very promising career in music before he chose...
In Southern Louisiana.
before he chose to pursue Catholic apologetics. But I look and this kid is just adorable, but he's being asked very adult questions and he's actually speechless and silent in many of those instances.
Yeah, they specifically directly asked him, you know, many people are not accepting, very accepting, as if we're supposed to accept all things and everything, right? That's
right.
Flawed in and of itself. But they started out, many people aren't accepting of things. So what would you say to, and many people aren't accepting of what you're doing. So what would you say in response to your critics? That was the question posed to the 11-year-old boy. And he literally was like, it's fine.
And then they changed the topic.
And then they immediately changed the topic. Correct.
And there were a couple times, at least once, where he doesn't respond at all. So then they just move on.
That's right.
And it's live TV. So what are they going to do? Yeah. You know, edit it out. But I see this young boy and he's dressed like he's a 20 or 30 something year old, acting very effeminate, feminine, very sexual.
And not only effeminate, but you just hit the key word, in a very sexual way.
Yes.
And when I was thinking about this, Timmy, I was like, man, this is like coming up to the threshold. I mean, you're literally walking up the sidewalk to the threshold of the door of child pornography.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that he was presenting himself and being celebrated and flouting his stuff in this sexual manner, I mean, that's, man, that's pointing the arrow to the target of child pornography, of course, which we recognize to be child abuse.
Well, and it was so creepy. I don't know about you, but they took three or maybe four of these famous drag queens that
Correct.
They invited out to meet Desmond. And it really just creeped me out that they're having these older men hugging this little boy and celebrating him for being a drag queen. And we all know, and if you don't know, that within the same-sex community, sexual perversion does step deeper with child pornography, with interaction, with especially it's celebrated if you can, you know, take the quote-unquote virginity of a young man or maybe even a minor. And so I was very uncomfortable watching. They were using this young boy in the name of, they introduced him as a future of bravery, but ultimately they're using him for entertainment.
Right. And you see, and this, I think, Timmer, is fundamentally what's driving Desmond. Like, we could recognize sort of a kernel of truth in sort of what's driving him. Like, he's, you know, he wants to be get noticed, you know, and he's, people are celebrating him. People are applauding him. People are affirming him. And those are all good desires, right? We want to be recognized and affirmed by others. That's a longing of the human heart. But we have to take a step back and ask the question, is this the right way in which we are to be expressing affirmation and affirming one? Because we first have to ask the question, is this a good thing to be doing? Is this morally permissible in the first place to be flouting around, for a man to be flouting, whether it's a boy or a man, to be flouting around in women's clothing? I mean, St. Thomas Aquinas actually addresses this in the Summa Theologiae in one of the parts there. Let's see here. It's actually in part two of the second part, question 169, article 2. He addresses this as well as in article 1 of that same question of why it's intrinsically disordered for a man to wear women's clothing in the considered it abstracting from of necessity, like Edmund in Narnia, right? He put on a woman's coat out of necessity so he didn't freeze to death. In those circumstances, you have the wearing of clothing in order to protect from the environment. But wearing women's clothing considered in the abstract has the end, the telos, since we would say in philosophy, the goal of visibly representing one state in life, right? So if a man wears women's clothing, it's sort of contradicting what it's meant for, right? And so it just violates reason and thus violates our rational nature. And Thomas Aquinas explains all of this. So we have to first ask that question, is this even appropriate? But then when we look at what's going on, as you mentioned, celebrating this sort of sexual nature of what this kid is doing, it's extremely harmful to the child's psyche and what it's going to lead him to when he gets older and he begins to wanting to act on those sexual aspects of what he's doing. And that's only going to lead him to unhappiness.
Well, and it ultimately points to this question. One, we're doing experiments with young children. We're celebrating and affirming them in a way that could be very detrimental. But ultimately, it's impacting the question of who am I? Yeah. When this little boy asks, who am I? Well, he's going to view himself as the person that everyone is celebrating and affirming publicly now on television and parades.
He's going to confine himself and restrict himself to that identity mode.
Exactly.
And live it out. Whereas if we could take a step back and recognize, okay, you like makeup, you like attention, you like glory, you like fame, right? You like hair, you like all of this stuff and clothing. There are other ways in which you can use your talents and your skills, other means by which you can achieve certain ends that deal with makeup, hair, and clothing, right? I mean, you can be, there are many ways in which you can act on those desires in a legitimate way.
Right. And also he mentions during the interview, and this really stood out to me, they kind of asked, well, what are you doing if you're not doing this? And he kept going, I'm playing with my trains. And there was a very, very young childlike element that made him even sound younger than he actually is. Well, I'm playing with my trains. There's a simplicity to him. And there are all these elements where you can channel an appropriate type of behavior and like in certain areas. And it sounds to me like they have just used this to gain fame and maybe attention.
That's right. And what's important, he says, referencing his parents, they support me in letting me do what I want to do. That's a very dangerous principle, right?
Right.
I mean, that's what he's perceiving from his perception. He's perceiving them as giving him free rein, whereas we wouldn't apply that principle of parenting, right? And ordering our children to the good in any other area of life.
And specifically, the mom, in reaffirming what he says, is I just want him what makes him happy.
That's right.
And this is the mistake that we have toward our loved ones every day. Well, if it makes them happy, why would I oppose it?
But we have to ask the question, what fundamentally is happiness? Yes, you might get some good feelings and you might get a degree of happiness where you're sort of having a good feeling that people are applauding you and affirming you.
But that's also pleasure, contentment.
That's right. But that pleasure, that feeling has to be directed and ordered by reason, by the intellect, in assessing the activity that the pleasure is attached to, and asking the question, is this activity that he's engaging in morally good for us or morally not good for us, right? And so this gets back to those fundamental questions that we have to be able to sift through the smoke screen and get through the smoke and ask these fundamental questions about what is being done and be able to separate that from the pleasure and the good feelings that's being attached to it. Because just because you get good feelings or something doesn't mean what you're doing is morally good, right? I mean, people do morally bad stuff all the time and get a lot of pleasure from it and a lot of good feelings from it, right?
But long term, where do they end up? And that question's being asked, Carlo, adding a little bit more to the same exact topic. There's a famous sex change surgeon who is having major doubts about transgenderism. He became very famous, Dr. DeJorgevic, and he
Good
has
job
come
on
out.
The name.
I know that's a hard one.
I was wondering how you were going to pronounce that. I was like, "Whoo! I'm glad I'm not the host."
But he was really the world premier in genital reconstruction surgery for people who identify as transgenderism,
right?
Specifically, men who want to have their body parts changed to female body parts. And basically, what he's come out and recognized that one, it's not making people very happy. And he's finding that many of these men are coming back and saying, I want to reverse the surgery. And so again, it comes back, did this make them happy in the end? And what he found is many of them were, quote, facing, quote, crippling levels of depression.
Yeah, he also says that they came back with a united, they were all, the people he's speaking about were united by an acute sense of regret. Mm. So they kept going into deeper and deeper levels of depression, he points out. And so that just, that's sort of an, that's a testimony to how when you divert from what is naturally good for us, there are going to be negative consequences for you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And this is where we see many actually of the surgeons or people who have worked in psychiatry very close to people who are identifying as transgender are saying, I'm not really believing in this. And I've been in this industry for years. And what happened is Dr. Minoslav ended up coming out and saying, hey, let's look at some universities and have them do research in this area so that we can more fairly look at this evidence of how can we follow these people, what their suicidal levels are, what their happiness levels, what the longevity is. And what's happening is these universities are rejecting doing any of the research because they're saying this is taboo. This is kind of getting into an area where, oh, we don't really want to get into the political correctness. We'd rather be comfortable not covering it.
Right. Yeah. You know, in that same article, it points out this may have been the study you're referring to, the 2009 study by the Department of Psychiatry at Case Western Reserve University. The researchers found that the most of the people struggling in this sort of lifestyle, 90%, had at least one other significant form of psychopathology.
Yeah. So we're finding that many of the people, and to be very politically incorrect but honest, are experiencing major signs of mental health issues.
Right.
And at the heart of the transgender issue, if you were to go back 5-10 years ago, this was gender dysphoria would be how it's labeled. And what we look at is even the American College of Pediatricians are re-emphasizing in a united front. These are pediatricians all over the country saying, this is child abuse.
With reference to the younger children who
yes.
Are requesting or their parents are requesting for sex reassignment surgery.
Absolutely. Well, and this is where it's a really important point because these young kids today are being allowed to receive hormone replacement therapy. They're receiving sex reassignment as young as 8, 9, 10,
right.
11 years old. But here's the reality. Once this child goes through puberty, specifically with boys who are experiencing, and it truly is a true medical diagnosis, is gender dysphoria. These young boys, 98% of them end up working it out and accepting their biological sex. And same with 88% of girls.
That's right. So that should give reason for those who are considering this to realize, well, just because a young person comes and, you know, a young male, young boy comes and says, well, I think I'm a woman, I need to have sex reassignment surgery, it should give doctors pause to say, well, you know, this is going to fade. This is not a permanent, enduring desire, right? And we have the research to back that up. And so, therefore, you should at least follow what we would call the silver rule, right? To not cause unnecessary harm, you see? And so it's sort of a minimalistic approach, but at the same time, it's still true.
And that's what's difficult. We're in an age where if someone wants some type of procedure, it's just given to them today.
Right. Without any questioning.
Right.
And you see, this goes back, what I keep emphasizing, the point of getting back to the fundamental questions of asking, is this action morally good or not? Is this in conformity with the good of human nature or is it not? And people aren't asking these questions, these fundamental questions about morality, right? And of course, we got to get some training in moral philosophy and assessing all of this. But the point being is that the intellect is totally left at the doorstep, right? Mm-hmm. And nobody is appealing to reason and to the intellect in order to properly govern the will and our behavior, because thought determines action. And we're only going to behave and act according to what we perceive to be good. But if this thing is truly not good for us, which can only be arrived at via intellectual reasoning, philosophical reasoning, if it's truly not good for us, then we ought not to do it. Getting back to the fundamental principle of morality, do good, avoid evil. But nobody in our culture is going there and is causing chaos.
And it's causing chaos for young children and basic development. It's confusing them further when parents just jump right away to some sort of psychological sex change evaluation, whatever it might be, when these kids are having real kid issues with intensified mental struggles at the same time.
Right.
And we need to show them unconditional love. And I think this is what Desmond is searching for. He's happy to know that my parents love me unconditionally. But unconditional love doesn't mean that you can't tell someone something's wrong or reject certain behaviors.
Amen. Amen. So the desire for the love is legitimate. But where he's being failed is in his parents and even the culture giving him what they think is love and giving it to him in the wrong way, because love is truly to will the good of another.
Mm-hmm.
But that presupposes answering the question, is this good?
Mm-hmm.
And unless we're first willing to answer that question, then we're just like wheels spinning in midair, right? Or our feet firmly planted in midair, to borrow from the title of Beckwith and Kokel's book on relativism.
Well, this appeals to this cultural attitude of immediacy. We want to immediately make sure he knows that he's unconditionally loved. We want to immediately find a solution to him. So let's just do the sex change as soon as he has questions about whether he's male or female or puts on that first dress.
Without asking questions ourselves whether we should be doing this or not.
Exactly. What's the long-term impact of hormonal replacement therapy? And, you know, that's something that the surgeon does talk about, is all these people are coming back wanting to reverse the sex change, but he's saying, I can't emphasize enough how painful of a transition this is to go back to the original context of your actual biological sex. And we've got to remember, part of what we're talking, part of the issue here, one of the parts is there's only so much skin on the physical body that can be manipulated over and over again. And this is part of, in many ways, the pain of the process of the people who are just basically manipulating their body parts to make them feel how they identify on that given day.
Right.
So talking about this idea of immediacy, last week on the show, Carlo, we talked about the chilling adventures of Sabrina the Teenage Witch. And it's a remake of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, also the very popular comic. And it was incredible how dark it was and how satanically deep it went into. They were saying things, Carlo, like praise be Satan, among other things. And I was shocked by how dark it is. But this last week, in light of Halloween, some studies have come out showing how basically witchcraft, Wiccan, whatever you, paganism, however you want to refer to it, is becoming increasingly more prevalent in the culture. And exorcists are continuing to speak out about this, specifically the fact that people are turning towards magic as some quick fix for things in their culture.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of this desire for, you know, it's the common, we've been formed in our modern culture into getting things immediately, right? We want the answer right away. And I even suffer from that myself in studying philosophy. I get this pressing philosophical question and it drives me nuts until I can get the answer, right? But we have this desire for a quick fix and immediate answers to questions or solutions to problems. And many are turning to witchcraft and paganism in order to get that immediate fix. But it's sort of it's the desire to obtain that secret knowledge, right? And because that's what happens when you engage in like necromancy and sorcery and conjuring up the dead and various practices of the occult, it's the desire to obtain secret and hidden knowledge that goes beyond our human powers. Now, for some, that desire can be good in the sense that I need a problem to the solution that I have, right? That's a legitimate desire. They're simply going about it in the wrong way. They're seeking a good end, right? But they are employing an intrinsically evil means to achieve that end. They're getting in the wrong vehicle, so to speak, to get to the destination, right? So some people, it's sort of an innocent motivation that's leading them to this. But for some people, it's just the desire for power. Mm-hmm. That if I can have secret knowledge and hidden knowledge beyond ordinary human powers,
or then even control over what's going on in this given crisis.
That's right. I can have power over you. I can have control over you. And therein, it's more evil, it's more demonic, because therein lies the highest sense of pride, to where we have absolute control over others and seeing ourselves as superior to others, when we're supposed to be viewing each other on an equal playing field.
And that gets into not only the area of control and power over someone, but hedonism, essentially, this desire to just feel pleasurable. And it's interesting, there was a bishop that came from Africa to the United States recently, and he was preaching at a parish here in Southern California, and he was talking about how in the West, the focus is on pleasure, hedonism, that's our society. But there in Africa, they experience a lot of spiritualism in this cross into witchcraft, among other things, and the demonic specifically. And how, you know, we've focused so much on pleasure for so long that as we're turning to witchcraft, it's more of an element of pleasure and control, like you're saying, over others.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Final thoughts here on the issue of witchcraft being increasingly more common and widely accepted in the realm of our desire for immediate responses to everything. I have in studio with me Carlo Broussard. He's a Catholic apologist with Catholic Answers and is also the recent author of the book Prepare the Way. Now, Carlo, you were talking about how ultimately, just during the break here, how this turn towards witchcraft and this desire both for control and power over things is also a look for something beyond ourselves, that there is a higher power out there that has the ability to change and transform ourselves in our dire circumstances.
Yeah, and in as much as one recognizes a transcendent reality, something beyond the physical world, that's a good, and that's something we can affirm as Catholics, that that's something that belongs to our nature as rational animals, but as rational animals, as religious animals. As Father Thomas Petrie states in that article from, I think it was the Catholic News Agency where we got this information from, he says, man is essentially a religious animal who seeks meaning beyond the ordinary, and so is prone to worship powers beyond himself. And fundamentally, for many people, that's what's driving them to engage in various occultic practices, because as a religious animal, they're seeking something transcendent. They're seeking something beyond ordinary human powers. That's fundamentally the craving for God. They're just seeking to satisfy that craving in the wrong things. They're seeking to achieve a goal or an end or a destination with an inappropriate means, right? And so as Christians, it's important for us to try and direct these people and say, you know what? I recognize your craving for the transcendent and something extraordinary and beyond ordinary power. I crave that too. But let me tell you where the real satisfaction to that craving lies. It lies in that or he who is infinite truth and infinite goodness itself, a reality that is so far transcendent and beyond ordinary human powers. There's this infinite gap between the finite and the infinite, right? And that, namely, that reality, namely, is God.
Well, and if we look at Revelation, the Ten Commandments, the first commandment is recognizing that we have one God, right? And with that, we see that throughout human history, making sacrifices is a fundamental part of who we are as a human person, different from the animals, because we have the ability to know we're offering this for something else. An animal doesn't have the ability to know that. And so as we're talking about this, I think that when we're turning to witchcraft and wizardry and all these different things, we're getting into the realm of, as some people would like to say, the Harry Potter type of occult type. And we've talked about, you know, yes and no to Harry Potter. And there's a fine line when we start to get into occult versus stories that show good conquering over evil. But I think this part of sacrifice is a big part of the transcendent. And naturally, we're drawn to it when people are picking up, for example, yoga, among other things, and even fasting. We're seeing it's more common for people who practice Hinduism and yoga to want to fast because they recognize that it takes their offering as something more than themselves.
Yeah, Yeah.
So we're going to come up here on the topic of sentimentality, right? Sentimentalism, and how it's really this new ideology. And I heard someone call it recently a heresy of our culture today, and how sentimentalism is really destroying the way we view ideas, the way we live. And there's this piece by Dr. Samuel Gregg at Catholic World Report. I'll be sure to tweet it out. And he starts by talking to his students when he asks them a question during seminar. He says, I want to know what you think about this. And he tells them they can't start off the conversation with, well, I feel this way, or right. I'm feeling this. They have to talk about what they truly think.
That's right. Because if, you know, I've actually thought about this on my own before even reading the article. I've always right. thought, you know, it's kind of one of those things you just kind of think about, and then you realize, wow, other people are thinking about this too.
I know.
It is true that in normal conversation, in everyday conversation, we often start off with, well, this is my opinion, right?
Right?
Or this is how I feel about the matter, right?
Or I don't know about you, but I...
Yeah, correct. So it's this idea of divorcing myself from any reality that's objective that we must conform to, yeah. right? You and me, right?
right?
Independent of what you or I happen to think. But what the author is pointing out is it's this appeal to feelings. Well, you know what? Maybe you feel that way, but that could be your lunch or something, right? Causing you to feel that way.
Your indigestion.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. You know, let's move on with our life. But if you think about something, well, then that implies that you're making an act of judgment of what's probable reality, what's probably real. So it's engaging that second act of the mind of judgment, which is making an assessment about what is real. So you're relating to reality as a rational animal. You're using reason. And what the author is pointing out here is the problem with this common I feel statement, and starting every statement off with I feel, it's a deprecation of reason.
Absolutely.
It's leaving reason at the doorstep, right, of the conversation, and only appealing to one's feelings.
And he's referring to this as people are living willing alone by feeling alone. That's their kind of moral compass based on how I feel. And it's funny you said this, because when I read this, it really stood true to me, because I remember probably about 2 years ago, I had a friend who anytime I'd respond, I'd say, if I said something like, I feel X, Y, and Z, they would get super triggered. I don't know, you know, in just the conversation, the debate we were having would completely change. And it made me start thinking, well, I just need to be really clear. I think this, take a second to pause, you know, making sure, am I saying what I think, or am I saying what I feel? And finding that fine line between that has become so confused in our culture that we don't actually know the difference today.
Right. Yeah. A professor, a university, my memory's selling me short here, but his name's Professor Michael Gorman, Dr. Michael Gorman. And he gives a couple of lectures on what he calls feelings management, and how that's sort of the governing principle of our lives in modern culture, that the task of life is to manage your feelings to where it's more so on the positive end rather than the negative end. And that's how I judge, according to modern standards, that's how we judge what constitutes the good life. If you have a bunch of positive feelings, and those feelings would include emotional feeling, emotional sensation, and physical sensation, right?
Right.
And so what happens is that we're constantly interacting with each other based upon, does this make me feel good or does this make me feel bad, right? And for many, it leads them to denying truth itself, denying certain moral truths, because that truth or that moral truth might not make me feel good. And because I'm in this feelings management endeavor, I have to weigh my feelings. And if it's not making me feel good, well, then I have to get rid of it. It's not part of my worldview. It's not a reality, right?
Which is so heartbreaking, Carlo, because ultimately feelings aren't good or bad. Bad feelings. If you feel sad, okay, you're sad. Doesn't mean you have to act on being sad,
right,
or act on being angry, but you can acknowledge, okay, this is what I'm experiencing, but let's live in reality of what is true.
That's right. And as St. Thomas Aquinas would teach, and many Thomistic philosophers will teach, is that we can actually train our feelings so that truth is first, and we live in harmony with the truth, and that we can actually train our feelings to be annexed on with living in accord with the truth in a way that is positive.
Being
right?
conformed to reality.
Being conformed, and that's the essence of sanity, to
right.
live in conformity with reality. And when we do that often enough and develop virtue and good intellectual virtues, moral virtues, the pleasant feelings will follow because we're naturally made for the truth. And when we live in accord with the truth, we're going to have the experience, the effect, and the fruits of the positive feelings that flow from that. And we can't use feelings as our criterion when judging things. I mean, like I said previously in our conversation, people do bad stuff all the time and feel great about it, right? Mm-hmm. Because they've trained their feelings to be positive in doing that which they know to be immoral. Well, the flip side is true as well. We can train our feelings to be positive in doing that which we know to be morally good, living in conformity with reality and with the truth. So the whole feelings management thing falls short in being our guide for the good life. There's other principles that we have to be looking to.
And it ultimately confuses us with our eternal destiny because it makes us confused when it comes to sin. Because right. when we're focused on a feeling alone type of attitude, we don't differentiate between what is sinful and what is not. In the article, Dr. Samuel Gregg talks about how ultimately, you know, we hear sin no longer referred to as sin often, but as pains, regrets, sad mistakes. And that makes us kind of downplay sin and what is bad in our society.
That's right, because once again, you've gotten rid of the intellect. So the intellect is no longer assessing whether this particular activity is contrary to reason or not, which mm-hmm. is the essence of sin, right?
Right?
Is it contrary to the order of good of our human nature? So if you get rid of that whole aspect and you're living simply based on feelings, well then, yeah, I could be engaging in something that is sinful and it makes me feel bad. But eventually, I keep doing it enough, I'm not going to feel bad anymore.
Right.
And so I guess it's not really a sin.
We've damaged our conscience. We've damaged Correct. Our sense of morality. We've now made it so that we justify even more so that type of sin.
That's right. And you know what's another interesting aspect, Timory, that the author brings out here is that when we're living simply based on feelings and this sentimentalism approach, what happens is whenever you try to fraternally correct me, I immediately perceive you as having ill will
mm-hmm.
because I've thrown intellect out, right? So I don't have that to base your correction on and saying, well, okay, well, maybe she's just mistaken in her intellectual judgment about what I'm doing, right? Because I've gotten rid of intellect and I'm only focusing on feelings and maybe even the will, well, we're just wheels, right? We're not intellects. And so whenever I'm doing something wrong and you try to correct me, I immediately perceive you as being judgmental and hateful and bigoted and against my will.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory.
Timory here with Catholic apologist Carlo Broussard. You can find his work at carlobroussard.com. Book him to speak. Pull up any of his musical wanderings here. He had a very promising career in the entertainment field before choosing to be a Catholic entertainer, more so educator instead. So, Carlo Broussard, you were telling me about this book, Smallfoot, Smallfoot, you went to see with your kids just a few weeks ago.
Animated movie
too, and it's really neat to hear some of the philosophies behind it that you unpacked.
Yeah, so immediately when I started watching the movie, I picked up on sort of this, what I thought would be an anti-religious theme. So I immediately pulled up like an article, right? I was doing the no-no thing of reading on my phone in the dark theater, right?
Oh no! Were people booing you?
No, they weren't.
Throwing popcorn.
I dimmed the dimming light. Okay, so I read an article. It's like, yeah, anti-religious theme. Be careful with your kids. And I immediately started to think, okay, how am I going to explain this to my kids? And you immediately perceive that there's this overbearing religious tradition, like the head, the chief of the tribe of Yetis. The movie's about, you know, a tribe of Yetis living on a mountain in a cloud, and they think that underneath the mountain, there is just this infinite number of mammoths, all right? But the point is that the chief wears these stones, and their beliefs are etched in the stones. And so you immediately say, okay, there's this belief tradition here. And the Yeti, the main character, is singing this song, right? And it starts talking about questioning the stones, right? And how we need to stuff those questions. But what's interesting in the scene, Timory, is that there's a group of skeptics, like the young adult Yetis, like, or the skeptical society about whether humans actually exist or not, what they call Smallfoot. And so the belief tradition...
So they call the humans Smallfoot?
Smallfoot, yeah, cute. Because they're huge, huge Yetis, you know, humans Smallfoot. So the belief tradition says humans don't exist, but the skeptical society says they do, and they have, you know, they're seeking, trying to find evidence for the humans. So the Yetis, the skeptical Yetis, are talking to these small children Yetis, right? One of the skeptical Yetis, the gal, says to the kids, so do you really believe that the mountain is held up on the back of a mammoth? And then the children say, mm-hmm. To which the other skeptic Yeti says, well, what is holding up that woolly mammoth? And then the main character, Yeti, comes to the children's aid and says, oh, don't listen to them. It's just woolly mammoths all the way down. Like there's an infinite series of mammoths. One mammoth holding up another mammoth, holding up another mammoth, holding up
and
another mammoth.
And that makes up the mountain.
And that infinite series of mammoths is that which explains why the mountain is above the clouds, right? And then elsewhere in the show, it talks about how if you fall off the mountain, you're going to descend into nothingness. And so I started thinking, well, by golly, something dependent upon nothing? That's another interesting issue, philosophical issue. Not only do you have the infinite series, right? We would call in philosophy an infinitely ordered series in an essential way, right? As opposed to an accidentally ordered series of temporal, like grandfather, father, son type of thing, right? Then elsewhere in the movie, the chieftain of the tribe speaks of how the truth is in the eye of the beholder. And I was like, wait a minute, that's relativism. But notice, relativism is associated with the bad guy. And the idea of an infinite series of woolly mammoths explaining why the mountain is held up, guess what, Timory? That's a principle that you have to hold to in an atheistic worldview. Mm-hmm. You're either going to have to say something came from nothing or there's an infinite number of causes giving an explanation for why something exists, right?
Something is or something is not. And you're either on one of those principles, and to say something is not is much more difficult to prove.
That's right. And so what we have here in the show is that it seems as if the overbearing belief tradition was actually an unreasonable belief tradition, because various elements of relativism and atheism were a part of that belief tradition. Even lying for some good. And the movie is all about, no, we shouldn't be lying for some good. Like, that's an evil means to achieve a good end,
right? That's the way the Yeti tribe worked.
That's right. And so, you know, the skeptical young Yetis challenge this overbearing belief tradition and bring about the truth of the matter, right? Mm-hmm. And that's actually a good thing. So I spent 20 minutes after the show talking to my kids about these philosophical issues, and I actually wrote an article for Catholic Answers Magazine online, which you can check out at catholic.com. It's called Of God and Mammoths. And basically what I do in the article, Timory, is I take that philosophical puzzle that they raised in the movie, like, can you have an infinite number of woolly mammoths holding up the mountain, right? That just goes down on and on and on ad infinitum. Can that explain why the mountain is suspended in midair? And so that's the philosophical puzzle that's raised. And then the article, I provide the answer to that puzzle of why the answer is no. You cannot have an infinite number of woolly mammoths to explain why the mountain is held up, and how that principle embedded in that applies to reasoning to God's existence. When you extract from that and apply it to just causes as such, just maybe there's an infinite number of causes ordered in this way to explain why the tree exists outside and why you exist and why I exist, and why that cannot be a reasonable explanation, that the only answer to that question of why you exist, I exist, or the tree outside exists ultimately is to arrive at a cause that is not caused to exist by something else, but simply has the power to give existence. And that cause, uncaused cause, is God.
Uncaused cause.
Yeah. So who knew that a kid animated movie could stimulate such philosophical investigations.
But this brings up a fantastic conversation, Carlo, because as you're talking about the movie Smallfoot, this animated movie for kids, you're pointing to the fact that every story really does have an underlying philosophical, theological mindset, hierarchy, way of being, and they're going against one way of being to articulate another. That's in every story. And so what you're talking about is you're really working with your kids to question movies, television shows, whatever they might be. And instead of being receptive, just sitting by and being entertained, you're encouraging your kids to be contemplative in what they see and to really reason out, parse out, well, what is true? What's a general theology or story we can find behind this?
Yeah.
And not to just sit back and be like, hey, this was a great movie, done.
Right. To actually engage the movie, to engage the mind, right? Yeah. Because we're rational beings and we need to engage rationally.
So that makes me ask a question here. I know a lot of people, especially listeners, always have questions about like, how much do we engage in watching TV, watching different movies? Mm. So what's kind of your general rule in your home?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm always on alert. I always have the antennas up on trying to decipher, okay, is this movie so bad that I literally can't let my kids watch it? Or is it something that I can let my kids watch and engage the movie with them and guide them through it in order to point out the philosophical flaws in the movie so that I can be the guardian of the mind, to guard the gate of the intellect, right? Mm-hmm. So that they can properly think and right ways and be able to identify erroneous thinking embedded in the movie, while at the same time enjoying the good aspects of the movie and the fun, watching a movie, relaxing, the fun that's there and the animated cartoon or whatever. So that's sort of, I mean, you know, so at first you kind of have to assess, or is this something we're going to watch or not watch? You know, is it like an absolute no, or is it a maybe? If it's a maybe, well, how much bad stuff is in there? I often use this rule of thumb. There might be a good destination, right? But if the vehicle to get to that destination is going to destroy the thinking of my children and destroy their soul and their charity, I'm not going to get in the car, right? I don't care how good the destination is. If the vehicle is so tainted that along the entire journey you have nothing but poison just to get one little kernel of truth at the end, then I say no. But if there's enough good in the movie with a little bit of bad thinking and bad stuff here and there that I can actually engage my children with, then we'll watch the movie and I'll point out those flaws.
And there's a fine line of difference between, okay, bad way of getting to a good end, but what is it that I myself or maybe my children are seeing in this movie? Right. Are they, you know, engaging in premarital sex, pornography? Is there such like an erroneous lie in the midst of what they're saying that I can't show? Or is it, okay, it shows a different type of lifestyle that we disagree with, wrong means, but it's something that we can actually point and look to and learn from that interaction.
Yeah, and it all depends on how much the means to arrive at the destination is going to affect my children. Like, I know my children and I know what they gravitate to and what the manners and the behaviors that they take on when they're around something. So if I perceive something in the movie that for my children, they're going to pick up on, right? And they're going to start acting this stuff out, like sarcasm or negative behavior or whatever, right? And if I see that the vehicle to get to that good destination is going to affect my children in a negative way, well then, you know, we'll make the call and say, no, we're just not going to watch the movie.
Well, and this is a great example because I know a lot of TV shows today, they've got a lot of teen power in them, overruling what the adults are doing. That's cute and it's fun to a lot of the teens or the kids. So they start to think, oh, I can act this way. Right. But you're saying, well, maybe this is a show that we need to avoid, step around.
Right. We can point out to the kids, you see how this show is making the parents seem like a bunch of airheads? What do you think of that?
Especially the dads.
That's right. What do you think of that? And we're constantly pointing that out. But, you know, there's some movies where they do that, but the movies overall is good and fun and we still watch it anyway.
And there are a lot of great movies. I mean, Avengers is another example of that. The latest Avengers movie where they point to different ideologies, yeah. such as genocide, for example. And that's actually the bad guy. But let's tease it out and discuss it.
Amen.
In with me today is Carlo Broussard. Where can people find you and your new book?
Well, they can go to shop.catholic.com for the book. They can follow all of the work that I do at Catholic Answers on catholic.com. And I also sort of streamline my material at carlobroussard.com.
Excellent. You can reach me on Twitter at Timmerie. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. If you enjoyed the show, send me a note. You can find me at radiotrending.com/contact.
This has been Trending with Timmerie. To learn more about Timmerie Millington, visit timmerie.com.